Welcome back to Current State. You can catch our program three times daily, Monday through Friday, here on WKAR, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM. We're also on AM 870 WKAR every weekday at 12 o'clock noon. Don't forget Current State Weekend as well. And all of it is always at WKAR.org. This is how I'm going to die. Our first guest came to that grim realization last November when he was attacked and robbed in his Lansing home. Todd Haywood is a reporter for the Lansing City Pulse. He is gay. His attackers were two men he had met through a Craigslist ad seeking sex. His assailants were targeting gay men. Adrian James Tupper and Aaron Christopher Spiker agreed to a plea bargain in connection with multiple charges and thereby avoided possible life prison sentences. Still, both were sentenced to 17 to 55 years in prison. Today's Lansing City Pulse includes Todd Haywood's account of the attack and the aftermath. Yesterday, I spoke with him about it. I first asked Todd Haywood for more about how he first met the men who later attacked him. I'll advise listeners that parts of this story may be disturbing to some listeners.
We met on the internet. We exchanged emails, multiple emails, over a course of several hours. We had a phone conversation. We had two phone conversations and a couple of text messages. They came over. We ordered pizza. Pizza came. We ate. We had a good meal. We talked. We laughed. We joked. And then it became a crime.
All of a sudden? Or
yeah, all of a sudden. There was one of the gentlemen said that it was time to go ahead and let's go have sex. And so as I turned my back to them to go into the bedroom, I was grabbed from behind. My hands were handcuffed. I was shoved under the corner of my bed and beaten by both suspects on the side and back of my head.
How long did the attack last?
The beating part of the attack lasted approximately 45 seconds to 60 seconds.
How badly hurt were you?
Initially, the harm was significant swelling on the left side of my face. I looked like an overgrown malignant squirrel. Swelling in the back of the head where they had pummeled me, as well as cuts on the side of my head. I think the most significant sort of remaining problem is lack of feeling in my thumbs from radial nerve damage from the handcuffs.
For how long did you think the evening was going to proceed normally?
Until that moment that they grabbed me and put handcuffs on me.
And that was how long after they arrived?
About 2 hours.
Wow. You thought, this is how I'm going to die.
Yes.
Were you in the process of giving up, or did it look that hopeless, or were you looking for a chance to elude these guys or fight back, or what?
Well, I think it's important to understand that as somebody who has covered hate crime murders, I'm aware that more often than not in an instance like this, the victim doesn't come out alive. Obviously, yes, I was looking for how do I get out of this, how do I escape, but in fairness, the initial response was the fear response, and that is to freeze and go quiet.
When you were thinking you were going to die, were there other rational or irrational thoughts, for that matter, going through your mind?
Well, I think the most irrational one was, good God, what will everybody think? I mean, what does it really matter if I'm dead? What does it matter what people are thinking? I should have been more concerned about, will they catch these guys? Will they ever find them? That sort of stuff. And that never really went through my mind.
You write that you knew you were a hate crime victim during the attack. How did you know that?
You know, in fairness, that's an assessment based on my experiences. You know, people don't come and spend 2 hours with somebody and then attack them and rob them. Generally, if it's not a hate motivated crime, if it's just a robbery, they don't spend any time. There's no connection, conversation, that sort of thing. They just show up and they rob you. So at that point, it became pretty obvious to me, again, from my experience and reporting on these, that this was a setup,
but
that this was anti-gay.
During the attack, did they use slurs, anything like that?
No. In fact, at one point, they pretended to be police officers. And, you know, in a...
Even after the attack had started?
Yeah. So, in fact, while they were searching the apartment, one of them yelled to the other to make sure that they searched the whole apartment so they could get a search warrant, which, you know, for you and I is laughable because that's obviously not how that works. But I figured that would probably be an unwise choice.
We're talking with Todd Haywood. He was the victim of a robbery and beating at his home last year, and his attackers have been sentenced to prison. He tells his story today in the Lansing City Pulse and here on Current State. He also writes about the incident for TheBody.com, a website devoted to HIV content. The case could be considered by state lawmakers who are fashioning new hate crimes legislation. We'll get into that in just a minute. They robbed you as well. What did they steal?
Yeah, so they took all of my laptops. They took my cameras. They took my digital audio recorders with all the audio files that I had on them. They took my cell phone. And they also took all of my HIV medications. So they took a lot. It was approximately, I mean, when everything was added up, it was almost $10,000 worth of stuff that they took.
And they took your HIV medications knowingly. I mean, for a reason.
Absolutely. In fact, they told investigators that they took my HIV medications because they wanted me to die of AIDS.
How did you escape, if that's the right word?
So when one of the suspects was done ransacking the house for the electronics that he was stealing, the other escorted me into my kitchen and told me to kneel. I did. He stepped out to consult with his conspirator, and I took that opportunity to jump up and shove my shoulder into the door, which shut the door. And I spun around with my hands still handcuffed behind me and locked the deadbolt. And the way my apartment is set up, standing there, I can look out the window into the parking lot. I saw the two of them look at each other like, what just happened? And they got in their van and drove away. At which point, you know, here I am, handcuffed. I had to go into my living room and sit on the floor to get my hands in front of me. My initial thought was, I'm going to get my cell phone and call 911. And that's when I realized the cell phone was gone. I got my hands in front of me and then went to the neighbors, and she called 911 for me.
Some people no doubt consider your actions reckless, but you did take some precautions. Tell us about those.
Sure. Let me first clarify for those who think that it's reckless to meet somebody on the internet. The reality is that this is dating in 2016. Yes, some people are still meeting in bars, but the vast majority of people are using social media as a way to meet. So this is not reckless or uncommon. This is happening gay, straight, bisexual, trans. It doesn't matter. This is how society is evolving. That being said, there are some real simple safety tips. Get a photograph, a face photograph. Get a cell phone number. Get a name. Get an email contact. All of those things worked together to really help identify these guys very quickly.
Tell us about the police response.
So I have to be real honest. I think the Lansing Police Department handled this phenomenally well. And I could not have been better treated by the detective who handled this case. I just don't have enough praise.
How were these guys caught?
Because I had their face photos, we were able to ID them. In fact, on 2 days after the attack happened on the 23rd, on Wednesday the 25th, I actually was sitting in the Lansing Police Department doing a photo lineup and was able to identify them from the photo IDs. A warrant was issued on November 30th, and they were arrested within hours by the fugitive team from the Lansing Police Department.
How much have you learned about your attackers?
Not a ton. I'm still trying to gain some more information on that.
And describe how the case made its way through the court system here in Ingham County.
In fairness, this went very fast in terms of the criminal justice system, right? I mean, there were two criminal cases that were associated with these two gentlemen. We do know that they were targeting gay men. There were three criminal reports that had been filed because of their actions. Two of us pursued criminal prosecution. There are more victims out there. How many they are, we don't know, but there are many more victims out there. Because there were these two criminal cases there and a lot of evidence, because they actually made a confession to the police when they were arrested and admitted to this and admitted that they were targeting gay men because they were, quote, sick, end quote, and wouldn't, quote, report it to the police, end quote. It was easier for the prosecution department to actually get a plea deal. Although even in that, we had some hiccups because there were some games being played by the defendants. But at the end of the day, Seven months to go from police report to sentencing is extraordinary in felony cases in Ingham County.
Are you satisfied with the outcome?
I am. And I'll be honest with you, I'm a little shocked at the sentence they got. I mean, they got 17 years to 55 years in prison. When I agreed to the plea bargain, I was told that the sentencing recommendation was probably going to be 3 to 5 years. So I, just like the defense attorneys, was incredibly shocked when the defense when the sentencing recommendation came back for 14 years, and was even more surprised when Judge Aquilina did 17 years.
You think your case could become a factor in legislation regarding hate crimes here in Michigan? How might that play out?
So I do have some indication that there is going to be hate crimes legislation introduced in July. Can't talk about the specifics yet, but I can tell you that we do believe that it is going to move forward. And I have a lot of hopefulness on that.
You also report that cyber hookup crimes are on the rise, both gay and straight. How much is known about that?
So there's no statistical tracking of any of that information. The only data that I could find on it was actually a blog from Law Media, which is bills itself as a crime reporting incident for the millennials. And they looked at between 2009 and 2013 cases that had been reported in the media involving murder and Craigslist, and they identified 58 cases.
We're talking with Todd Haywood. Todd was the victim of a robbery and beating at his home last year. His attackers have been sentenced to prison. He tells his story in today's Lansing City Pulse and here on Current State. He feels that the case could be considered by state lawmakers who are fashioning a new hate crimes legislation, and he says he expects that. You connected to the men who attacked you because you'd placed this ad seeking sex with another man or men on Craigslist. There have been warnings over the years about using Craigslist. Dangerous people sometimes respond to these ads, and not just the sex ads either, and then they commit crimes beyond the obvious. Why, in the end, were you willing to take that risk?
First of all, you can meet dangerous criminal people who have dangerous intents anywhere you go. You know, Bob Gross, who was the sports reporter who was murdered in 1996, met his killer in a bar on Michigan Avenue. Alden Judge met his killer driving down the street. You know, nobody shamed them for meeting their partner, these killers. So I want to be really clear that people with ill intent find ways to get to victims in multiple ways. That being said, since I was diagnosed with HIV, I have had social anxiety. And I know that that's strange because people see me on stage on a regular basis and they see me doing the reporting thing. But that requires taking medications to control that. And going into a bar for a social event is extraordinarily painful to me. It actually causes massive panic attacks, and it's just not an opportunity for me anymore. So really, the internet has become one of the only ways for me to meet people. And then you can add on to that, you know, being a person living with HIV in the state of Michigan right now, where we have this very draconian law that has been very poorly interpreted by the courts, I have to disclose my HIV status prior to sexual penetration. And the courts have been very clear that the only evidence that they'll accept is time-stamped evidence of disclosure. Well, I could meet somebody and say, hey, I'm going to videotape this disclosure. That's pretty dangerous. We know for a fact that people have been murdered because of their disclosures. I reported on a case out of Dallas, Texas, about a woman who was stabbed to death for disclosing her status. That happens on an infrequent but far too frequent basis in the United States. And the other choice is to use emails to make that documented time disclosure. And that's what I have found myself being forced to do.
To people who hook up or date through the internet the way you did, what advice do you have?
I did everything that they recommend that you do. And what it shows is that when you get that face picture, when you get those cell phone numbers, when you get that email address, when you talk to them by cell to verify that they're actually the person, that if something goes wrong, there's evidence to get those people quickly.
You're a reporter for a publication that is gay-friendly. Your story indicates that there was a similar attack 5 days after yours. Why didn't the City Pulse cover your attack sooner? I mean, isn't it possible that other crimes might have been prevented if this story got some attention sooner?
In fairness, I was requested by both police and prosecutors not to discuss the case until the perpetrators were sentenced, convicted and sentenced. In this case, they pleaded guilty.
We've been talking with Todd Haywood, who writes about being the target of a gay hate crime in today's Lansing City Pulse, as well as for the website, thebody.com. Todd Haywood, thanks for sharing your story with
us. Thanks for having me.
And coming up on Current State, Thunder on the Grand is a nonprofit that raises money for young cancer patients in Michigan by throwing a huge annual event. This year's theme is Mad About Cancer with Mad Max-inspired activities. We'll find out all about it in our Neighbors in Action segment here on Current State. That's coming up. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Film and literature are full of stories of people doing crazy things for love. Romeo and Juliet sacrificed their family loyalty and their lives. Jack froze to death to rescue Rose as the Titanic sank into an icy ocean. And Ann Arbor-based writer R.J. Fox boarded a plane to Ukraine to propose to a woman he had met only once. He details his crazy adventure in his recent memoir titled Love and Vodka, My Surreal Adventures in Ukraine. I spoke with R.J. Fox earlier this year about his travels in Ukraine and first asked how he ended up boarding that plane with a ring in his pocket.
That is a great question. I ask myself that every day. So back in 2000, I had gone to Universal Studios. I was there on a cold, rainy day in L.A., and I was out there for some screenwriting seminars because my first sort of writing venture was in screenwriting. And I just happened to follow this girl onto, it always sounds like I'm a stalker, which I guess I have to just accept that fact. So I spotted a girl also by herself. I was by myself. And I ended up riding the ET ride with this person who turned out to be from Ukraine. We struck up just a 20-minute conversation. She had to leave. And she was actually living in Mississippi at the time as an exchange student. We spoke just 20 minutes, exchanged contact info, became pen pals, and then less than a year later, I had the harebrained idea to take a ring over there and propose, and that led to just some crazy adventures in a very, very crazy but very fascinating country and culture.
Sounds like a special 20 minutes, though, was it?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty mundane, run-of-the-mill, just, you know, of course, you know, the Hollywood setting maybe made it seem even more romantic, but there's nothing romantic, actually, about those 20 minutes. It was just a very, you know, sort of, hi, how are you, where are you from? You know, and then over time, as we started writing to each other through, you know, through email and chat, we got to kind of know each other and became, you know, in many ways soulmates. And it just felt like something that I just had to do. I mean, she just felt like the one. And so, yeah, I boarded that plane. And
what were you thinking as you were getting on that plane?
I was thinking, I hope my parents don't really realize I have an engagement ring in my pocket, which I was able to sneak on.
And you didn't tell your parents you were planning to propose to Katya.
Nope.
What was their reaction when you told them that you were flying across the ocean to see a girl you'd only met once in person?
Exactly. They thought it was kind of strange, but, you know, they knew they had a strange son on their hands, and it didn't seem that out of character for me to do that. I mean, they definitely were a little cautious, but, of course, had they known I was going there to propose, they probably would have talked me out of it, which is exactly why I didn't tell them. Now, in hindsight, they were probably right, because the marriage lasted 8 years, and it ultimately did not pan out the way, you know, we had hoped it would, but the 8 years of marriage overall had some great moments, and particularly the trip that I took, again, back in 2000. Just these amazing, surreal experiences, which are highlighted in the book.
When you got to Ukraine, you stayed with Katya, is her name, Katya's family,
correct,
who are quite the characters themselves. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, well, you know, her parents were definitely from the sort of old school Soviet era. You know, they grew up during the Cold War. You know, she was born at the end of the era, but her parents definitely were right there in the heart of it. And, you know, and the city that it takes place in, Dnipropetrovsk, was a closed city during the Soviet Union. It was very... basically, nobody could get in there who wasn't in that city already. And it was also sort of the center of missile building during the Cold War. So it was all the missiles being made that, you know, aimed our way were being built right in that town. So there was sort of a general distrust towards outsiders, even at, you know, and again, maybe things have changed since 2000, but at the time there was still, you know, especially out in public. In private, it was a whole different matter. I mean, in homes and in the families and friends we visited, very warm and inviting, and these great toasts that were like poems. And but then, you know, out in public, it was always, you know, don't speak English, and the glares I would get. Taking a picture of a person's goat got me into a lot of trouble, which is one of the highlights of the book. So it was this kind of dichotomy of public life versus private life, and just that Soviet distrust that sort of, you know, in many ways, a stereotype, definitely. Just like the vodka, were very much true in my limited experience with the culture.
The family that you were about to marry into had had a lot of this distrust of foreigners, including Katya's babushka, or grandmother.
Right, especially her.
Yeah.
I think the older the person, the more distrust they had towards especially towards Americans. And I think it just makes sense with the history that there would be that sort of that distrust of the Western world. And here I was, just, you know, I would be called foreigner a lot. By random people. And, you know, her parents were definitely very gracious, you know, very accepting, and very, you know, it took a while to warm up to them, but they definitely, or warm up to me, I should say. I guess it went both ways.
R.J. Fox is the Ann Arbor-based author of Love and Vodka, a memoir about his time spent in Ukraine pursuing his future wife. When did you decide, R.J., that you wanted to turn these experiences into a memoir?
Pretty much right away after I came back from the trip, or even during the trip, because I always think like a writer, like, oh, this would be great for at the time as a movie script, because that's when I first started writing it as. I came back in September 2001, just before 9/11, actually, and started writing the book just weeks after that. The screenplay. So finished it as a script, optioned it to a producer, thought it was going to actually get made into a movie, but then it sort of got stalled. When the producer dropped the project after the option expired, I decided to, rather than just cry about it, I decided to turn it into what became the book. So I was able to kind of build off of what was already an outline, a skeleton of the whole story. I was able to then add in all the stuff that couldn't fit into the constraints of a screenplay. And it actually was very liberating to be able to write the full story as it happened, as opposed to more of like the Hollywoodized approach to it that I had to do with the producer. So It had to be written down, and whether it was going to get published or not, you know, remained to be seen. But fortunately, Fish Out of Water Books took a chance on me, and it's been a great few months trying to get the word out there about the book and sharing the experiences.
The book is called Love and Vodka. R.J. Fox of Ann Arbor is the author. You write a lot about a lot of memorable moments in Ukraine. Is there any one experience that was really a lot of fun to write about?
You know, ironically, the one that was probably the most fun to write about was the one I least remembered, and I could thank my good friend Vodka for that one. There's a scene called, or a chapter called The Sobering Method, where I basically learned how Ukrainians, or at least her family, sobered up their drunken guests that were force-fed vodka with one toast after another. And literally, just in a nutshell, I was stripped down to just my underwear and forced to march back and forth on a rocky road barefoot, which... It must have worked, because I did not wake up hungover, but I certainly...
Good times.
Yeah, it was. I had to be... A lot of that part of the story had to be kind of reminded to me back by my... at the time, my wife, who had to explain to me exactly what had happened in detail, because I could not remember every moment of that.
What do you think were the biggest lessons that the Ukraine chapter of your life taught you?
I would say just an appreciation and a more sort of open-minded approach to other cultures... you know, as opposed to just sort of judging another culture for being so different, sort of learning to embrace the differences and realizing that, you know, even in a society where there's a lot of poverty and strife, there could still be a lot of happiness and an appreciation of life. And I think maybe even more so than people who have a lot more that we take for granted. So I think it just, you know, and at the time I was in my early 20s and now I'm late 30s. So I feel like I definitely have a more, I guess you could say, mature understanding of the world than I would have had before the trip. So it definitely opened my eyes to just a whole other life, which I only knew superficially about, as opposed to actually being immersed into it.
Does the film idea still have legs, RJ?
Well, in my mind, for sure. I mean, my ultimate goal is to come full circle back to the movie. Of course, I have, you know...
Who would play you? Who would play you?
That's a good question. There's been different actors in mind over the years. recently, and it's somebody who doesn't even look at me in the least, but Aziz Ansari from his Netflix show Master of None. Watching his new show made me realize this guy could totally play the character. Well, I want to say a character because it is sort of a character, even though it's me. Just the way he portrays that character on his show would be perfect for Love and Vodka. I've thought about people like John Krasinski from The Office, Zach Braff, but that might have been, I think they're both maybe too old for the part at this point versus a few years back. So yeah, there's certainly a long list of actors I have in mind and actresses. But yeah, I'm hoping that's my ultimate goal, is to still see this get done as a film. I think it would just be a great, funny, romantic comedy with kind of like a My Big Fat Greek Wedding meets Lost in Translation. So I'm going to keep fighting until it happens, and I'm hopeful. Based on how well the book has done just initially here, I'm optimistic. I'm on the right track towards that part of it.
We wish you luck.
Whether I'm delusional or not is a whole other thing.
R.J. Fox is an Ann Arbor-based writer and the author of the memoir Love and Vodka, My Surreal Adventures in Ukraine. R.J., best of luck. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
And coming up on Current State, it looks like we're in for a hotter and drier summer than usual here in Michigan. We'll learn why from Michigan State University climatologist and geography professor Jeff Andreessen. He spoke with Dr. Kirk Heinze recently about the weather conditions that are creating the summer of 16. That and more coming up after the break on Current State. A news story you may want to know about here being published today, and this is if Detroit's school challenges are of interest to you. We've covered this fairly regularly here on Current State. New York Times today, a sea of charter schools in Detroit leaves students adrift, is the headline. Reporter Kate Zernike in today's New York Times. A sea of charter schools in Detroit leaves students adrift. That's in the NYT. Today, it's Current State here on WKAR. Many nonprofit organizations are involved in fighting cancer and supporting cancer research. Here in mid-Michigan, there's one that focuses on another of cancer's challenges, paying medical bills. The Lake Odessa-based Thunder on the Grand raises money for children with cancer whose families are financially struggling. They do that with a huge annual event that offers everything from motorcycle races to slip and slides and lots more. Joining us for our Neighbors in Action today, Laureen Wickens, founder of Thunder on the Grand. Hello, Laureen.
Hello there, Mark. How are you?
I am well. It's good to have you here. We're also joined in the studio by Jen Fuller, the mother of a 10-year-old girl, Layla Kay, who's been diagnosed with bone marrow failure, and the Fuller family is one of the beneficiaries of this year's event. So we wanna welcome Jen Fuller to Current
Thank
State
you
as
much.
Well. Nice to have you here, Laureen. Talk to us about where the idea came from for Thunder on the Grand. How did it all get started?
Oh my goodness. My daughter had cancer a year after she gave birth to twins. And it was lymphoma, and so I envisioned myself as being a grandmother raising two children, and my daughter was a single mother and did not have funds to pay her bills and whatnot, so I had to step up and do that. I also am a three-time cancer survivor myself. My mother passed away when I was 15 from cancer, and we just were looking to do something, and it just seemed like there wasn't enough out there for children to benefit from that didn't have the resources that a lot of adults have.
Got it.
And so I worked for Thunder Roads magazine, a motorcycle magazine, and I wrote articles, and I met a woman that was out of Battle Creek that her grandson had passed away from brain cancer, and she did fundraisers for St. Jude's, and her and I got talking, and she thought it would be a wonderful idea if I started something in Michigan that benefited Michigan children only.
And who exactly do you raise money for?
Thunder on the Grand is a nonprofit organization, and what we do is we raise money for children that don't have a lot of resources for help with medical bills, paying for medical miles that they have to travel back and forth. We have a lot of families that, you know, with the economy down, some of the families aren't working, they don't have insurance. There is a lot of programs out there for them to go with, but those insurance companies only cover certain things, and a lot of the medicine and stuff isn't even covered.
Okay.
So,
very good. Let's talk to Jen Fuller here for a second. Jen, your daughter Layla was diagnosed with bone marrow failure and then later with aplastic anemia. Tell us a little bit about the journey you've been on with Layla.
Well, she was first diagnosed at 5 years old as a fluke at the allergist. He asked me if I had any other questions or concerns. And I said, you know, she bruises extremely easy. Could we just, you know, take a look at that? And so he sent her in for some blood work. And little did I know that day my world would be turned upside down. We were sent directly to Sparrow, where she was admitted immediately. That night, they were going to send her to Mott's Children's Hospital in Minneapolis for a bone marrow transplant. Her levels were that bad. Fortunately, she has kind of went up to the point where she is maintaining at this point. About 2 years ago, we found out that being even worse than cancer, and I can't even believe I'm saying this, but worse than cancer, she has no other alternatives except a bone marrow transplant. There is absolutely no treatment for her specific condition.
This is a platelet issue.
Correct.
Correct, in her bone marrow. Is the Fuller family the sole beneficiary of this year's Thunder on the Grand then? Is all the money raised going to go to you, or is that getting split up?
No, I don't believe
up?
So. Oh, no.
Okay, okay.
That's however they do that. But they've so generously donated even a space for me to come and do a bone marrow drive during the program. So I will be there swabbing mouths, doing everything I can. We are desperately looking for a donor for her. Lorraine was so graciously just invited me in with open arms to help us on several different facets.
Are you contending with a timeline here?
Anytime. I prayed for a donor yesterday. She could go downhill in 5 minutes from now.
Now, will the money raised improve the chances of finding a donor?
Not necessarily. The money raised obviously is going for these programs that Lorraine had set up for, you know, helping financially. Getting the word out there and getting people on the donor marrow registry is the key to finding her a donor.
I'm speaking with Jen Fuller, the mother of a young girl with bone marrow failure, along with Laureen Wickens, founder of the event and organization Thunder on the Grand, which is working to help the Fullers and other families in similar situations. This is a big event meant to raise money to help defray costs of families with a member who has a young person who has cancer. Laureen, I know there are other families that you have helped here. How many years have you been hosting Thunder on the Grand?
This is our seventh annual this year.
Okay.
And so we are very excited about that. A lot of events don't last that long. our numbers are way up this year. So we're really in hope of a really great turnout this year.
There's a lot of fun events here, which we'll get to in just a minute. I know you've helped other people, obviously, over the course of those 7 years. Laureen, talk to us about one or two.
Well, there was Harley Van Zandt. She was out of Battle Creek, young girl, 14 years old, who had bone cancer, and it went to her lung. All of the volunteers just fell in love with her. She was awesome. She had lost her left arm, and one of her things was that she wanted to be able to ride a motorcycle. She also wanted to write an article and do photos. She wanted to be a photographer. So I invited her to go out and help me write an article for Thunder Roads Magazine. We took pictures. We published the article. It came out just shortly before Harley had passed away, unfortunately. But she did get to see that she did, you know, achieve her goal. We ended up helping with the expense of Harley's funeral. And that's how we ended up helping that family, unfortunately. And sometimes it does come down to that. There's also Bryce that we have helped out of Battle Creek as well. And then we have Jaden Lamb out of Midland that we have donated funds to for the toy drive and stuff that they do in memory of him, because obviously he passed away before we could actually get the funds to help. So it's important for us to get the funds, you know, so that we have them available, so that as soon as we hear of a child that really needs our help, that the funds are available to those children. And
let me bring Jen Fuller back in here briefly. Jen Fuller, what can people do to help Layla?
First and foremost, sign up for the registry. The registry is not only just for children with aplastic anemia, but tens of thousands of children with bone cancer and other lymphoma and other types of cancer need bone marrow transplants. And the consensus is people are so afraid to get to be a donor because it used to be extremely painful. It is not that way anymore. It's almost just like giving plasma. So getting the word out, getting people tested on the registry, you know, is helping just a ton of people.
What's the easiest way to become a transplant donor?
It's very simple.
Make the officials aware that you're willing to be a donor.
You can go online, order a kit. They send it to you. It's a simple swab of the mouth, takes less than 10 minutes, and it sends right back in the mail free.
But
and it's
that is
on the
where...
National Registry. It is with Be the Match, is the number one bone marrow registry. You can, there will be a link set up for Layla. It is just bethematch.org. Her specific link would be join.bethematch.org/Michigan2016. You would still be on the National Registry. They are just now counting how many people are wanting to become new donors because of her story.
Laureen, let's talk a little bit about the event. There's a lot of things going on here. Just give us a sample.
Well, we have on Friday night, we have a live rodeo coming. Lost Nations Rodeo is going to be putting on a great show for us, and that's at 7:30 in the evening. Our theme this year is Mad Max, Mad Against Cancer. We change our theme every year to match something to do with cancer, to make it a fun event. We're doing drift trike racing, which is a go-kart rear end, a bicycle front end with a motor on it, and they have PVC pipe over the back tires, and they just slip around, and it's very hard to control them, so it makes it really fun to put on a show with that. We have mud bogs going on. We have motorcycle games going on. We have a car show and truck show, motorcycle show, a Mad Max vehicle show. We have the slippery slide that's 150 foot long.
All kinds of things.
The music that we're going to have is just absolutely fabulous all weekend.
Music as well. All the information is at thunderonthegrand.com. thunderonthegrand.com. I know volunteers are a big part of Thunder on the Grand. What kinds of things do they do?
They help with the gate. They help. We have what we call the Thunder booth, food booth, and people help in the food booth. They help in the information booth. They help at the different locations to set up the different events that are going on, stage management, sound, you name it.
Different kind of volunteer opportunity here. It's obviously a fun event, but it's one with a very serious purpose here as well. Jen Fuller, remind us, where does this happen? This is Thunder on the Grand. It's near the Grand River, I take it.
Yes, it's at the... Go ahead, Laureen.
No, it's at the Lake Odessa Fairgrounds. We did hold it by the Grand, and that's why the Grand River, that's why it was called Thunder on the
Got
Grand.
Got it.
But
okay.
We moved it since then. So.
Well, Jen, we wish you and the Fuller family nothing but the best here. You've got quite a serious challenge on your hands. Hopefully this year's event will make a difference, and you will connect with a bone marrow donor very, very soon. For Layla Kay. It was. Thank you for sharing your story with us here today.
Thank you so much, and thank you, Laureen, for involving Layla and making her a part of this and just opening your arms and wrapping our family right in it. You are truly a blessing to us.
Well, you guys are just a blessing to us, and I have to say that Jen is one miracle mama. She has another baby that has issues as well, and her husband has just been deployed. So she's a single mom now.
Okay.
So she's got her hands full.
I'll tell you what, we have to leave it there. I've been speaking with Laureen Wickens, founder of Thunder on the Grand, and Jen Fuller, the mother of a young girl with bone marrow failure, who the organization is working to help. Laureen, Jen, thank you. Best of luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Current State is looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out and email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Please put Neighbors in Action in the subject line. Last week's arrival of summer brought us the seasonal forecast here on Current State. Michigan appears to be heading for a warmer, drier summer than usual. That's the what. Today we bring you some of the why with Michigan State University climatologist and geography professor Jeff Andreessen. Jeff speaks with WKAR's Dr. Kirk Heinze on climatic topics related to Great Lakes biology, carbon dioxide levels, and how the summer of 16 has come to be.
We've just been through, depending on how it is defined, but it's certainly one of the strongest El Nino events of the last century here. It began last summer. It took it a while to get going, but once it did, it was a big event globally. And why it matters to us, something in the equatorial Pacific, many people always ask, well, that's thousands of miles away, and it's true. But the issue is that El Nino and La Nina, these two phases, are associated with very unusual, sometimes almost reversals of normal sea or ocean current patterns and atmospheric patterns as well. And ultimately, many of these patterns influence the pattern or flow of the jet stream around both hemispheres, both the north and south. And of course, for us here in the Midwest and in temperate areas around the world, the jet stream is the primary controlling factor for our day-to-day and week-to-week weather. So if there's something that influences that in the Pacific, it matters to us. And what we see typically, we find certain types of weather patterns that are associated with El Nino. It tends to, both of these things, El Nino and La Nina, tend to happen during the Northern Hemisphere winter and spring months. And not always, but more often than not, they do. And when we do have El Ninos at this time of the year, typically our winters across the Midwest and much of the northern U.S. Tend to be milder than normal. And within the Great Lakes region, they also tend to be drier than normal, statistically. Not all of them, but more often than not. So that's why it's important. ENSO, or El Nino Southern Oscillation, turns out to be the most important tool in the long lead outlook prediction business that there is, and it hasn't been known about for that long, but it's a very, very important component of global climate.
I'm talking with Dr. Jeff Andreessen, state climatologist for Michigan. I'd like to get into the something we always talk about this time of the year, our lake levels. Mm. One of the problems, as you well know, in Lake Erie is the depth of that, that's one of the factors that's conducive to those algal blooms that form in Lake Erie. Lake Erie is just by nature, in and of itself, shallower than the other lakes, right?
That's right. It behaves a little bit differently, especially in the winter. It's the first one to freeze over because of its depth, and again, it just behaves a little bit differently than a lake, say, like Superior, where you've got much more volume of water, and it's more complex, mm-hmm. What goes on there, the depth and so forth. So the biology and ecology is a bit different as well, but all the lakes, at least the upper lakes, have recovered pretty significantly since, especially though Superior and Michigan.
And of course, this is a little bit aside that comment, but all the research that's being done in the Great Lakes and the Great Lakes restoration and the attention that the mayors and agriculture are paying to our crown jewel, really, is got to be good news to a climatologist, but it's got to be good news for society in general.
It is, and I think it's a reminder. It's one of the most valuable resources that we have. And unfortunately, it's like everything, there are limitations, and we have to remember that, and it has to be protected. And it's encouraging to see that there are rules and such in effect that do look at the long-term sustainable outcome that we all probably want and need.
Jeff, let's turn to a topic that's much more problematic, and that's carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere. We're moving north. We're over 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide now. Climate patterns and carbon dioxide concentrations, is there a relationship?
There is. It's a very, very strong relationship. And we know over geologic timeframes in Earth's history that when we have had high carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases as well, such as methane, when those concentrations in the atmosphere have been high, so have air temperatures at the same time. And where it starts to become a bit more complicated is what precedes what or what begets what, and we've seen both ways. But we know without question there's a very, very strong correlation between the concentrations of these gases and our surface temperature. And the climate has varied dramatically. Of course, we in Michigan here from tropical to glacial and everything in between, just as an example of that. But as you mentioned at the beginning, the rising concentrations now beyond 400 parts per million are a real concern and are very likely associated with some of the increase in temperature that's been observed globally here, certainly over the last 1 to 2 centuries. And basically past the from the end of or beginning of the Industrial Revolution up to the present. Very, very rapid increase in emissions of these gases, but we also have warming, and there's been some news globally that I think is certainly important, and we have set a number of new all-time records for global temperature that are worth noting, and one of them is just, we've set an all-time new global high temperature for the warmest, and that's combined land and ocean temperatures on our record. That essentially goes back about a century and a half, but it's still noteworthy, and it's still an indicator that our global temperatures are continuing to increase and again have reached new highs. A couple of the other ones, though, virtually all of the highest temperatures have occurred within the last 20 years, and some that are eye-openers. 13 of the greatest 15 monthly departures from normal on the positive side have all occurred in the last 15 months, including the highest temperature on record, which was set earlier this spring. And associated with that, of course, we have near record low levels of sea ice and rates of melting as well. Those are all correlated. One other one that's worth noting, too, I think, is that it's not only our conventional observing network, which is thermometers or temperature sensing devices around the world. That's been our conventional one. There's also another set of data taken from satellite that looks down on the Earth and basically can sample every square mile or foot, as it were, and very, very accurate. The problem, of course, is it's much shorter in duration. It only goes back to the 1970s. But this particular record, it measures temperatures in roughly the lowest 5 miles of the atmosphere. So it's not the same thing as what our conventional network does, but it's still looking at the lower part of the troposphere, the lowest major layer of the atmosphere. And it has risen over time, but it hasn't behaved quite like the surface series that I mentioned before. And that was listed as a concern in terms of what's going to happen or what's happening. That has recently also set all-time new records. So the comment was that this particular satellite record is not increasing. So there's something wrong here, something that's not adding up. That's no longer the case. That record is also showing.
That's becoming more consistent with the.
It is, and again, it isn't the same thing. That's the most important thing to note. But it also has recently reached new record levels. Now, that said, an important caveat is that some of this, the record high temperatures that we've observed here over the last year, are associated with El Nino. Remember, warmer than normal sea surface temperatures over thousands of miles of the equatorial Pacific. That's part of it. There also, interestingly, are record warm temperatures in much of the Indian Ocean basin at the same time. But collectively, much of the world, not all, but most of the world is at or near record warm values right now. But these oceans, which cover, of course, 70% of the globe, when they're that warm, averages all show positive or all show large deviations from normal. And so El Nino's part of it, but it's still a longer-term trend.
For those who would suggest that this can all be attributed to normal or historic climate patterns as opposed to human activity, what would you say?
There's a growing research, lots of research to suggest that that is not the case, that the warming of the last century and a half just can't be explained by the atmospheric noise alone. And there's quite a bit to support that. At least some of it is we have to look at the greenhouse gas emissions. I think that's the only real explanation.
Well, on that note, it's been a pleasure, as always, to talk with Dr. Jeff Andreessen, state climatologist from Michigan and professor in the MSU Department of Geography. Jeff, I hope we get some rain here in the next few weeks.
You,
I know you do
you
as
and I
well.
Both.
But
yeah.
Thanks so much for being a guest on Greening.
It's my pleasure.
That was Michigan State University climatologist and geography professor Jeff Andreessen. He was speaking with MSU Today's Greening of the Great Lakes host, Kirk Heinze. We will see you this evening at the Allen Marketplace. It's another live storytelling event, pop-up stories, with Current State 5:30 to 7 p.m. We're glad you could join us today. It's Current State on WKAR.